are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. New from the best-selling author of Wrecking Crew. During the early morning hours of July 17, 1983, fatigue became a factor for the young couple from central Illinois who spent their day under the hot sun at Marriott's Great America Amusement Park north of Chicago. On their drive home, the tired teenagers pulled to the shoulder of Interstate 55 to get a restful sleep. As the teens slept inside their car, under the moon and the stars, a dangerous force of evil lurked in the shadows, parking directly behind them. The summer of 1983 was like no other for Joliet, Illinois, a hard-working, rough-and-tough, blue-collar industrial city an hour's drive southwest of Chicago. This was one of the hottest summers on record for Joliet, and an elusive serial-killing madman kept piling up the body count as he showed no signs of being caught. One overnight killing spree claimed five victims, including members of the Will County Sheriff's Office. The following month brought more bloodshed, a quadruple murder inside a small Joliet shop best known for its pottery classes. The plague of senseless violence sparked the controversial New York City-based Guardian Angels to mobilize foot patrols in Joliet, generating more unwanted news media attention for the community. Even the National Enquirer produced its own sensational piece labeling Joliet Terror Town, USA. Residents shuddered with horror. Determined detectives worked in overdrive, trying to find an overlooked clue or two. Finally, when an arrest seemed to come out of nowhere, area citizens breathed a sigh of relief. Authorities linked the so-called stone-cold killing machine to a chilling count of 14 homicides, plus three women who miraculously survived their agonizing encounters. But with multiple murder trials on the horizon, it remained anyone's guess whether Milton Johnson, whose family nicknamed him Biggin, short for Big One, was guilty of mass murder, and if so, would he die by means of lethal injection at the Illinois Department of Corrections. The book that we're featuring this evening is Terror Town, USA, the untold story of Joliet's notorious serial killer, with my special guest, journalist and author, John Ferrick. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, John Ferrick.
Thanks for having me on again, Dan. It's a great opportunity to be back.
Thank you so much. We haven't heard from you since your best-selling and incredible Wrecking Crew, and you're back with Terror Town USA. Congratulations. Let's get to summer of 83, and you talk about this very, very unusual time, summer of 1983 in Joliet, Illinois, and you were 10 years old. Tell us a little bit about that time and this turning point in your life and why.
Well, the one thing that really stood out about the summer of 1983 was that it was just unbearably hot. Obviously, all summers in the Midwest, especially around Chicago, are hot to begin with, but that year was just incredibly brutal. And then on top of that, we had this unbelievable, senseless killing spree that just seemed to come out of nowhere, and it just really frightened and terrorized, you know, the entire community. These were not, obviously not, you know, gang-related or drug-related homicides. These were, you know, mass murders, you know, two to three to four, sometimes five people were getting killed at one time. And it just seemed like all the victims were, these crimes were just happening out of nowhere and eerily were random. That's the way it seemed. So, you know, as a 10-year-old kid, you know, I was, I think I was a paper boy at that point in time. 10, 11, and 12, I pretty much passed the newspapers. And there was another, person in my neighborhood, it was like two or three of us that split up the routes, and there happened to be one murder that happened just about five or six houses up the street from where I lived, right on Mills Road, and it was an 82-year-old widow. And that was just, I mean, incredibly shocking because I had a grandmother, grandparents, well, they were both alive at that point in time, that lived just two other streets over from me, you know, so to have, you know, a widow, a woman in her 80s, who lived alone, just murdered five or six houses up the street from you, you know, and then to hear about it, you know, read about it in the paper, but then also kind of hear secondhand, I mean, which was true as far as some of the facts, that she was found, you know, in her living room chair, you know, beaten to death at the time. And, you know, at that point in time, Dan, I mean, nobody knew who the killer was. So it was, you know, again,
right.
Another murder happened. And, you know, and of all people, it's a 82-year-old woman that lives by herself. I mean, that just was scary for everybody. And certainly was scary for me being a 10-year-old kid, just trying to make sense out of life. And, you know, I paid attention to, you know, Major League Baseball, Chicago White Sox, Chicago Cubs, and my Little League team that I played with. And then you have all this going on in your neighborhood and around the city. It was pretty, you know, pretty mortifying.
Mm-hmm. You talk about 10 years later, you were a sophomore in college studying journalism at Eastern Illinois University. Summer of 1993, you returned to Joliet as a newspaper reporter. Intern. And so you got to hear the stories of from veteran journalists about that summer of 83 and the terror and the ensuing murder trials. Tell us what happened after college and how you came to meet Frank Cerveniak and the idea of, about this book.
Well,
was germinating.
As you pointed out, I spent the summer of 83 back in my hometown, working for the local newspaper, and obviously, again, that was pre-internet days, so, I mean, newspapers were still very, very strong, and, you know, that was pretty much the place, you know, for information. They had a really good newspaper at that time, so it was really, worthwhile, and I, you know, picked up a lot of, you know, intelligence just from hearing the stories and working with several of these veteran reporters and editors and photographers who had been around 10, 15, 25 years, you know, and they talked about Milton Johnson and just, you know, how scary of a time that it was in Joliet, you know, the previous decade. It's always interesting, again, to kind of learn each town's, you know, some of their most shocking crimes. And you know, the summer of 83 was always on a lot of people's minds. I eventually, you know, moved on after college. I worked in South Bend, Indiana for a while. I came back to the Chicago suburbs, was in Green Bay, Wisconsin, out in Omaha, Nebraska, and then back to Wisconsin again. And then 4 years ago, Dan, is when I returned back to Joliet, my hometown, to work as a reporter and editor for the Joliet Patch, which is the main news organization. We're an online only, you know, news outlet. And so I was kind of getting my feet wet, just kind of, you know, reacclimating with a lot of people in town. 4 years ago, right around this time in the summer of 17. And I wound up going out for lunch with one of the premier lawyers in the area. Frank Cerveniak, it's a hard name to say and spell. I still have a hard time spelling it, even though he's a pretty, you know, well-known lawyer. But Frank and his firm went out for lunch with me, you know, and we were just talking, you know, that day, and he knew a little bit about some of the other books I had written over the years, and he just, you know, pointed out that there had never been a book ever written about Milton Johnson, and you know, in the summer of terror from 1983. And what was also interesting too was that one of his law partners, Stephen White, who's in the 70s now, but Steve was one of the key prosecutors on the Milton Johnson cases, and again Frank was just of the opinion that, you know, nobody's ever written a book about, you know, Milton Johnson, even though he's probably one of America's and North America's most notorious serial killers, but yet there's very little known about him. So I gave it some thought. I kind of always had this case, to be honest with you, Dan, you know, on my unofficial little sheet of, you know, I don't want to keep a sheet, but just kind of keep a sheet in my head as far as of, you know, of, here's four or five possible books to at least think about, you know, for my next project.
Right.
And when I returned to Illinois from Wisconsin 4 years ago after doing the Stephen Avery book on Wrecking Crew, you know, I wanted to try to find something back in this area here around the Chicagoland, you know, Joliet area. For me, it's always been easier to do books, you know, in a town or a state or an area that I'm familiar with. I do get requests, you know, every few months somebody will send me something, you know, about a case in Tennessee or Seattle or California. And I just don't pursue those from the standpoint that, yeah, if I'm not really familiar with that town or that area, I really don't think, you know, I'm the right person to be writing that kind of book. So I really want to write books only about areas that I'm familiar with or have access to a lot of key people. And so when you mentioned, this story with Milton Johnson, I really thought that, yeah, that could be, you know, that has strong potential. And I felt the fact, too, that there had never been any true crime book really done on Milton Johnson. That in of itself was a strong reason to pursue the research and see where things would lead. I knew I had a lot ahead of me, though, too. I mean, I knew if I undertook this project, it was going to take several years. It wasn't going to be a, you know, 3 month project or something like that. I'd have to put in the time and effort. But if I did that, I also felt there would be a good chance that it would be a, you know, well-researched book product in the end.
You talk about that research, and this is pre-internet days. This occurred. Obviously, you're doing your research was more difficult. Tell us about some of that difficult research and why it was so difficult, and what ensued.
Well, I mean, again, the thing about Milton Johnson, similar to a lot of the other notorious serial killers, oftentimes, you know, there's the cases or the crimes that they're convicted of. But then there's the other cases that the police, you know, have them as the prime suspect, or there was strong evidence, physical or circumstantial, you know, that for different reasons, oftentimes just for legal reasons, but that they may not be prosecuted for. And to do the Milton Johnson book, I wanted to, you know, really step back and analyze any and all the cases that that he was a suspect and really try to look at the evidence and see if it matched what the police and the prosecutor's theories were. Making this book a little difficult, yeah, like we said, there just isn't a whole lot that you could easily find by, you know, just, you know, going to the internet or to do research on Google or, you know, even a different true crime blog here or there, you know, or even news organizations. So one of the best places for me was there's a little office annex that the Wilk County government, Wilk County's the main county for it's one of the biggest counties here in the state of Illinois after Chicago, but Wilk County is where Joliet's at. And the county has a little office building on the west side of town where they keep all their old archives, you know, going back to the 1800s or early 1900s. And so I wound up, you know, working something out where I would go over every Wednesday for about 2 to 3 hours in the morning from like 9 to noon for several months. And they pulled out these big, you know, boxes that probably weighed about, I don't know, 80 to 100 pounds each. And there was probably about 3 or 4 of them. And those inside those boxes then contained, you know, all the old trial transcripts, some, but not, you know, not most of the police reports, but court exhibits, and then a lot of appeals documents. And that's kind of where I started my research as far as to kind of get an idea of, you know, who are some of the key people that were involved in these, you know, in this case, or these cases, I should say, plural, who were some of the key witnesses. And then just to try to get a better idea of, you know, who I'm dealing with as far as, you know, police officers, prosecutors, witnesses, you know, and, of course, Milton Johnson. And so that was really very, very helpful. And then I would go through and try to figure out, okay, these are the documents that I want to pay for, you know, to make copies of. And, you know, these other documents here are interesting to read, but really I could tell ahead of time these are going to be, you know, boring, and we're not, you know, there's, you know, they're dealing with appeals that really are, you know, not of, of much interest to true crime readers or even myself. So, you know, so those documents, you know, really weren't worth my time to copy. So it, once I figured out kind of what were the key documents that I needed to get my hands on, from there then it made it a lot easier to kind of figure out what other cases that I needed to research and pursue as well.
In your research, you come across February 15th, 1970, very important date in everyone's, in everybody's history involved with this, but especially Milton Johnson. And you talk about a person named Lee Chandler, and this is an alias, but Mary West, his girlfriend, drove to Pilcher Park, and they were dating, these two people. And so they have an encounter with this person. Tell us what he says to this woman and what he says to this young teen, and what happens as a result.
Well, he, again, it's February. It's really cold. I think it was in the teens, or single digits, or in the teens at the time. And he's coming from the opposite direction. So the roads through the forest are, you know, pretty much one-way roads, you know, and there's a little area in there for cars to pull up and park, you know, go for walks, that kind of stuff. And he was coming from the opposite direction, and he started by asking them, you know, an innocent question. You know, he asked if he was, like, going the wrong way. So he's really not, you know, threatening or really doing anything that that scares them at all, Dan. And then he comes back later, couple minutes later or so, and then this time when he comes back, though, he's got a gun with him, and he orders the girl, the teenage girl, to get in the back seat, and he makes her boyfriend, you know, lay on the floor in the front seat of the car, and he proceeds to you know, commit just a violent attack against her, raping her savagely, while the boyfriend, you know, is helpless in the front seat of the vehicle at the time. And it's just a really scary encounter, you know, for this, you know, this teenage couple. The last thing they ever expected was just, you know, somebody to come out of nowhere in the middle, late at night, and their lives are in line, and, you know, he's beating her, he breaks her jaw, you know, at one point in time, he goes back to his vehicle, you know, and has her boyfriend get out of the vehicle for like a couple minutes or so. And I remember he kind of goes through a series of questions with the boyfriend. He asks, like, you know, have you been cooperative? You know, have you been doing what I asked? That kind of stuff. And then he makes a comment to him about, you know, wanting the doors of the vehicle to be left open, you know, while he's going to shoot them both, you know, and the boyfriend's just going to run into the woods, and, you know, and just miraculously, he survived, and, you know, and nobody was shot and killed that night then, Dan. So that was really, you know, just a chilling night. And I remember the Joliet police were quoted in the Herald News the following day after the arrest was made. You know, just the detective said that was like the worst, you know, beating, a sexual assault case that he had ever encountered.
You write that he wanted to shoot both of them at the same time. That's what he had told the boyfriend, that he'd want to shoot them with one bullet, to shoot both of them at the same time. And so that's what he had asked him to get into position for. And also, how did they find out that he was the perpetrator? Tell us how they found that out, the obvious reason.
Well, I'm guessing he must have panicked, you know, when the boyfriend ran into the woods. He's going to drive, you know, his victim, the girl that he had just beaten and assaulted, he's going to drive her up to the hospital, the Silver Cross Hospital at the time, and was just a couple miles away, if that. And so it's going to be, you know, witness identification. You know, she's all, you know, she's going to identify him as the assailant, and so is the, you know, the boyfriend. And the boyfriend ran into the woods. He got to a phone, and I'm trying to remember if it was a motel or a hotel or just something there. But you know, he got somewhere where he was able to get somebody to call the police, and so the police were able to respond to this crime very, very quickly. And and basically, Milton Johnson was arrested, you know, on the same night that this crime happened. And it took me a while, but I eventually found the original newspaper articles on the crime. And that's one of the challenges too sometimes, Dan, you know, when you go back on a case that's 40 or 50 years old. I mean, I did talk to a couple of different police officers that were involved, you know, or people that knew some of the details of this case, but ultimately, you know, the best source for the information was the old newspaper articles, as far as, you know, what was factual and what actually did happen. And and I heard different stories about the Milton Johnson arrest, but the fact is, yeah, it happened on the night that this terrible, awful crime had happened out at the Pilcher Park Woods. And just for perspective, this crime just really terrorized the community. So, I mean, Pilcher Park for a number of years then had a bad reputation, as far as, you know, people were just scared to go there at nighttime, you know, because of this violent, you know, late night attack that happened out there.
Mm-hmm. You write also that he burned her with the cigarette lighter on her private parts, just to add to the torture that he was inflicted upon her. You talk about this trial, and her boyfriend Lee testified at this trial, and he was sentenced to 25 to 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us how it happens that he is paroled in 13 years.
Well, that's interesting in and of itself. And just for people to kind of have a better understanding too, I did find there were a lot of articles about just generally in Illinois that the state was facing a prison overcrowding, or overcrowding of its prison population. So I can't say definitively that was the reason he ultimately didn't serve the 25 to 35 years that he was sentenced to. But it's interesting. I tried to spend some time in the book actually chronicling, you know, his prison reports, you know, and I did have some success. And again, those were documents of all places that I found at that little Will County, government archives building. A lot of his prison reports were in the appeals documents, so that was really valuable to find. And so he did. It seemed like, by and large, despite that crime, and despite the fact that he felt that he was being railroaded, the sentence that he got was unjust, he did, by and large, behave, you know, and conform to the rules and regulations of the Illinois prison system when he was in Pontiac, Illinois, at the Pontiac Correctional Center, which is about 80 miles or so from Joliet. And while he was there, although he wasn't a perfect inmate, and I do document a number of issues that he had, but by and large, the longer he stayed in prison, the better he behaved and the more privileges it seemed like he was acquiring. And I also found it interesting that it seemed like he made, you know, connections with a lot of the higher ups or the people in prison that had power, you know, to help him out, or, you know, and there was certainly one woman in particular that I mentioned that she seemed to give him a lot of leeway, you know, and she gave him two or three times where she, gave him good behavior, and that just constantly would just reduce the minimum sentence that he needed to serve. So even though nobody back in Joliet and Will County was ever expecting him to return, you know, to the community in the summer of 1983, the fact is by getting a lot of these good behaviors, 90 days off his sentence here, another 90 days here, and another 90 days there, these were starting to add up, and it made it, you know, a lot easier. So I think by the fifth or sixth time that he went up for parole, even though he was constantly rejected the first few times, Dan, you know, based on the severity, you know, the seriousness of the crime and, you know, and that sort of stuff. The fact is, he was ultimately paroled in the March of 1983.
He also made a friendship in there from somebody that was from the outside that had interaction with the kitchen staff where he was assigned. And this person would write him, and they began a relationship of sorts, especially at the beginning with through correspondence. But later on, she factors into this story near the end as well. You talk about him released in March, and you also write about all of the parole hearings and the work towards him getting his parole. And despite not having any employment opportunities or prospects, he was still paroled. Now, on June 17th, 1983, you take us to this Silver Cross Hospital and Teresa McKean. Mm-hmm. And she's just leaving this hospital. And what does she encounter?
Well, she was, she was working that night. And it was late at night. Around midnight or so, I think 11:30 to midnight, 12:30, and she's just goes back to her car, you know, and is just going to make a, you know, 4 to 5 mile drive home on Route 6, which is a two lane highway that runs right past the Silver Cross Hospital and over by the EJ&E railroad tracks too. So, but she just gets in her vehicle and starts to drive home, and then on her way home, a pickup truck kind of pulls alongside of her while she's still driving, because again, there's no real stoplights or stop signs in this area. It's just 50 mile an hour speed limit out there, and she's thinking this vehicle is going to pass her, and instead, next thing she notices is that there's glass shattering from her window, you know, and turns out it was somebody shooting at her vehicle from that other vehicle. That vehicle then pulls way, way, way up ahead of her, you know, and is eventually able to fire several more shots at her vehicle, missing, thankfully. But she's terrified and is able to make it home, actually. She lived just a few miles up the road there then, and she gets a hold of the police and Illinois State Police actually came out to investigate that crime, but she's very lucky that she survived and wasn't harmed. But that's really like the first major crime that happened in the summer of 1983 that didn't lead to a murder, but that was kind of the MO, you know, for the person that was going around causing this terror. It was a late night crime. He seemed to be scouting out for his victim, preying on women, you know, and it's a kind of a dark night on a lonely road. And this Teresa McKean seemed to be a potential perfect victim for this late night psychopath.
You write that she thought there might have been another person in the truck. And in fact, when she reported it to police, she said that there was two people in the truck, and the police went with that there was two people in the truck. Then Milton Johnson was stopped. But because of that possible that there was two people in the truck, Milton was stopped by an officer. What happens when Milton is stopped? End question.
Well, yeah, he's found... on the side of the road, and I think he had his the hood up on the pickup truck at the time. And, you know, the officer, you know, took his identification and, you know, and, you know, spoke with him. But, again, working off of the, you know, what the woman had, what Teresa McKean had said about, you know, two people, she was, you know, she thought there might have been two people in the vehicle. It does not lead to an arrest that night for Milton Johnson. I am thinking in hindsight, you know, if they would have brought her to the scene or I should say even not to the scene, but just if they would have, did a little more thorough questioning, maybe, I mean, she would have had a chance to identify this guy. But I think, you know, the state trooper that was working that night, he was working off of the premise, you know, that based on what she told him, you know, that two people were in a truck and one of them was shooting at her. He just happened to see this guy parked on the side of the road with his hood up, and Milton Johnson did not do anything, you know, to draw attention to himself or, you know, or act like he was involved in that shooting. So so the officer, you know, let him go, and he was not taken into custody and not arrested that night then, Dan.
Mm-hmm. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. According to Forbes, gyms, nail salons, hotels, mom-and-pop stores, and more are set to go on an epic hiring spree in the coming months to meet the pent-up demand for all of these services. I'm excited to be able to go to see a movie at the theater. I want to see Stillwater, and I want to get to see some live stand-up comedy again. All of these businesses reopening means that millions of jobs will need to be filled. So where do these businesses turn to fill these roles fast? ZipRecruiter. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, they send your job to over 100 job sites, giving you access to their network of millions of job seekers. ZipRecruiter's matching technology scans resumes to find qualified candidates for your open roles and proactively presents them to you. ZipRecruiter's technology is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, we were talking about this failed opportunity to be able to stop Milton Johnson before this murder spree took off a week later on June 24th, 1983. And we talk about these two sisters, the Blum sisters, Nora Lahman and her sister, I've forgotten her name here.
Zita.
We're talking about Nora and her sister, Zita Blum, pardon me. And what happens at their home? They live side by side from each other. What happens one day? Who finds these sisters and discovers the horror?
This is, you know, just an unbelievable example as far as just how close the crimes, you know, hit to, you know, to the community, especially to the local police that had to investigate it. So Pete Haas, and he was a sergeant at the Will County Sheriff's Office and one of the key, investigators in charge of the detective unit. He and his wife, Jean, they have about a 70-acre property on Rosland Avenue, right on the outskirts of the city of Joliet. So at that point in time, there was about 7 or 8 houses along Rosland Avenue. Most of the people that live out there at that point in time, you know, had horses, you know, and were really involved in, in farming, too. And the newspaper carrier pulled into their driveway on a Saturday morning, sometime shortly after 6 or 6:30, and told them that it looked like there was smoke coming from one of their neighbors' houses. So Gene and Pete, got dressed really quick, and Gene wound up going to Zita's house, and then Pete went to the house where the fire was at, which was Nora's house, and then also at the same time too, you know, fire trucks from the East Joliet Volunteer Fire Department were also on their way getting out to the house. And Pete, Pete was one of the persons then that found both of the sisters in the house. And it was a really bizarre, just horrifying situation. So there was a small little fire that had been set in the back bedroom of the house. It was a ranch house at that point in time. And he found both of the sisters, their bodies were in the bedroom, and they were already dead, and and they were burned well beyond recognition by that point in time. And the crime then was just really creepy and just sick. He and the other Wolf County sheriff's officers and then the East Joliet firemen, they found the bodies were stacked on top of each other. So they had been put into a sexual position, into a 69 position. And both the women were already murdered. They were already dead by the time that they were set on fire. So so whoever was setting the fire was clearly trying to desecrate their bodies and I'm not even sure what the words are to describe it, but just it was just a really sickening scene. And for for these two women who really had no enemies at all in the world, it just really defied logic as far as how who in the world would target them, and pick them out for such a brutal torture type of crime. And so to go back to the other house then, where Jean Haas went to the first house, she found that that the door, the back door, had been ripped off by such just sheer force. So whoever broke into the house just basically shoved the door so hard with such great force and might that they even though the door had a little lock across the top, one of those just little ones. I remember my grandma used to have one of these too, where it just you just put a little bolt on one side and then slid the other part across the way. But so whoever committed these crimes first went to Zita Bloom's house, and there was blood on the walls and blood on the floor, so it was apparent that she had been attacked, and whether she was killed there or just knocked out or incapacitated, but whoever did this, clearly started at her house and then took her to her sister's house and continued with the carnage and the rest of the bloodshed place over at Nora's house, which is where the two sisters' bodies were both found.
Now, while police are investigating this horror scene, you talk about July 1st and Eric Johnson and his wife, Terry Lynn. Tell us about this disappearance.
Well, this one was another mystery at the time. We had the first weekend in July, so what kind of sheriff's office already busy trying to solve this this double murder involving the Bloom sisters, which just came out of nowhere and just again shocked the conscious of the community. The wife of Eric Johnson and then the husband of a woman named the woman's name was Anna Chancellor, but her husband Kenneth Chancellor, they both disappeared on that first Friday night in July of 1983, and it took a few days ultimately for the authorities to find the two. They eventually realized that Kenny Chancellor's vehicle, his wife's vehicle, was found that night, and it was left parked on some really rural railroad tracks out. Several miles outside of Joliet, but kind of right on the county line for Will County and Cook County, and Cook County is the county where Chicago's at. But the vehicle was found right inside of the Cook County area, and it wasn't really apparent as far as where these two had wound up. The police wound up checking a lot of the area hotels and motels, to see maybe if Kenny Chancellor had checked into one of the hotels, something like that. And meanwhile, again, Eric Johnson, he's got like two real small kids, and one of his kids was going to have a birthday that weekend, that they had a big birthday party planned, and he's wondering, where his wife's at, why she didn't come home. She worked at a White Hen Pantry convenience store at the time this happened, and she had, she had a lot of friends, and was known to frequent a lot of the different local bars just to hang out. So the police went to a lot of these places as well, just trying to figure out, had she been there? Did anybody see her? Was she with anybody? That sort of stuff. And eventually, sadly, the two bodies of Terry Lynn Johnson and Kenneth Chancellor are both going to be found within a couple days of each other, out in the drainage ditch that really had really tall weeds, and the bodies weren't easy to find. It took, again, several days for the police and family members and, just searchers just to try to, find them. But, again, they were checking the area, Dan, mainly where the car was found. They figured that was probably the best, place to be searching. And the scariest thing of all out of this was when they eventually did the autopsies for the two of them. They found that they were both shot. They died of a bullet wound, but it was almost prophetic to that 1970 crime that did not turn into a double murder, but in this case, it did. The two died of a single bullet that went through both of their bodies. And in one of the newspaper articles I saw, referred to it that way, that it was, one shot, two killed, in the senseless crime spree. And again, just these two were out there. They were out parking that night. So they were, they were married to different people, but they, they got together and were spending time with each other. And somebody, this killer just lurked out of the shadows that night on a Friday night and just came upon them and shot them dead and then dragged their bodies, several hundred yards to different locations and just left them out in the sweltering heat, just with, where the maggots and the insects, were going to, do their thing, unfortunately.
You write about a very important character in this story, Ann Shoemaker. She's 19 years old, and she attends a party. And she left the party to go on a walk with her friend, and a truck whizzes by. What does she see, and what does she decide to do? And what is the description of the man in that truck, according to her?
Well, first, she was... When this first happened, she and her friend kind of ducked down in the weeds and they thought this whoever was driving this vehicle may be out to get them or find them and later then they came to the belief that maybe it was just somebody at one of the parties that they were at or a friend of theirs that was just kind of trying to play a prank on them, knowing that they had left the party and went for a walk. So they decide to go back and get their own vehicle and see, very bravely, I probably wouldn't have did it if I were in their shoes, but they wound up going out to try to see if they could, tail or, follow this vehicle to see if they could get a better idea of who it is, this goes on for several minutes over several, a few mile area, just kind of at that point in time, this was a very rural, farming region just right outside of Joliet, Illinois. And they eventually wind up, going back and catching up with some guy friends of theirs and telling them about this. And lo and behold, then this truck just comes streaking past them, and squeals the tires and continues onward. But they're at least able to get a good description of the guy. He looked to them probably like 25 to 35. He was, had an Afro hairstyle at the time, was African-American, and he was driving a dark colored pickup truck at the time. And eventually, again, yeah, they and their boyfriends or, you know, guy friends wound up going out and try to follow this vehicle, you know, a little bit more and actually have a close encounter on one of the roads where they're coming over a hill or cresting over a hill, you know, and this vehicle is just kind of parked on the side of the road or, you know, kind of on the, yeah, the side there where it's almost they have to kind of swerve to avoid hitting him. But the girl's smart enough to at least write down the license plates of the vehicle, you know, and she eventually is going to call it in to the sheriff's office, you know, that either that weekend or the following weekend. It's sometime in the near future. But again, since there really wasn't any crime that had happened that night, and I'm sure the sheriff's office, you know, was short-staffed and only had a few people on and, you know, didn't really know of anything going on, I could see how a tip like that, although well-intentioned, may have kind of fallen through the cracks and really wasn't, you know, put at the very, very, very top, you know, of the,
right,
you know, things that we need to investigate at the Will County Sheriff's Office at that time.
Mm-hmm. Let's use it as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. A week later, the following weekend, this is July 16th, 1983, you have a Denise Foley. He's a veteran U.S. Army volunteer safety patrol. He works at the Will County Sheriff's Office in Joliet. And he's partnered with an officer, Stephen Mayer, who's 22 years old. And his father is Edward Mayer III, a sergeant at Will County Police Department, or Sheriff's Department, pardon me. Now, at July 16th, 1983, Richard Paulin, they called him Dewey, 33 years old, and Kathy Norwood, who's 25 years old, are parked in their little Chevette. And this is in Lamont, a little population 5,000. And Will County Sheriff Pat Lombardo is on patrol. Can you take it from there? What happens to this couple? And what does Pat Lombardo able to do, or how is he involved?
Well, it's this one's going to be the most complex and just senseless crime out of all the ones from that summer. It's out on a rural stretch of an area that we call Homer Township, and it's generally in the same general area where this previous weekend's encounter had happened with Ann Shoemaker, you know, where she saw a vehicle truck that was kind of following her and trolling around, you know, the rural parts of Homer Township. But on the weekend of the 16th and 17th, it's about 3 to 3:30 in the morning, and by the time Deputy Pat Lombardo gets to the scene, he's going to come upon the Will County Sheriff's Office auxiliary car that's going to be parked on the side of the road there. He's going to see the little red Chevette parked kind of on the entrance to the farm, kind of off in the grass. And there's also going to be a third vehicle that's going to be about another quarter to a half a mile down the road. That's a van. And that vehicle had crashed into the bean field over there, and the driver of that vehicle was dead. The passenger, she was shot and shot in the shoulder, and miraculously was not life wasn't in danger as far as just even though she was wounded, but she was able to run to one of the farmhouses covered in blood, you know, screaming hysterically about what had happened. And so that spurred even more, you know, police to descend on the scene. But the two Will County Sheriff's auxiliary officers, Dennis Foley, age 50, and then Stephen Mayer, 22. Stephen Mayer was shot several times, and he was found dead in the ditch on the side of the road there, not that far from where the red Chevette is. Dennis Foley was able to survive at that point in time. He was able to use his police radio, you know, and even though he was shot in the mouth and shot in the hip, shot in the abdomen, he was able to at least make radio contact to let the Will County Sheriff's Office know that, you know, something terrible had happened. And then the two people that were driving that little red Chevette, Kathy Norwood, she was found dead, fatally shot. She was found right outside of the vehicle. And Dewey Paulin was shot. He was shot dead inside the back seat of his own vehicle. So at that point in time, you had four fatalities and two survivors. And unfortunately, Dennis Foley died 1 month later from the injuries that he had sustained at the shooting there. So we had five fatalities then.
You write about underneath auxiliary deputy Stephen Mayer's body was what? And what did they garner from that information?
That was one of the first major clues, at least, to emerge. And it was a fishing reel receipt that was made out from a local shop that was called Walt's Tackle and Bait Shop. But the receipt at least was made out. It had a name on it. And it was made out to a guy named Sam Myers, M-Y-E-R-S. And Sam was in his 50s at that point in time. The receipt was really fresh. So the police didn't think this was just something that they had just come across out in the middle of the field, you know, just while they were investigating all these multiple homicides out there. And so the police initially started to look at Sam Myers as, you know, being a prime suspect for these killings, and realized that he was, like I said, in his 50s, and he had an ironclad alibi. He and his wife and some other family members had made a long trip down the Mississippi for several days as part of a family vacation. And plus, he didn't match the description that Dennis Foley, you know, the officer who was shot but survived at that point in time, he was able to give a good description of what the shooter, you know, had looked like. And it was nothing at all like Sam Myers. So the police kind of worked off of Sam Myers, but then once they realized that he couldn't be the killer, they kind of backed off and kind of had to start from scratch. But they at least had the information that something somehow connected him, or at least perhaps his vehicle, to this crime scene. Otherwise, that receipt wouldn't have ended up underneath Stephen Mayer's.
You write about Ray Tusick. He's going fishing, and what does he find?
It's the very next day, and he's on his way down to the Kankakee River, and he's driving on the old, what's known as the old historic Route 66. It's now just called Route 53, but he's driving on his way to go fishing, and he thinks that he sees, what looked to him like an arm, in the median, in the grassy median of the four-lane highway here. Whether it's divine intervention or who knows what, but he decides, he pulls over, backs up his car, and goes back there, and he finds this woman that had been, viciously beaten and assaulted, and she'd been stabbed as well. So he finds her in the middle of the road there then, she's clinging to life. So he thinks really fast, notices another vehicle that's coming down the road, and he flags down that individual, a guy named David Sims, who worked at the Illinois, Youth Correctional Center. So these two guys who had never ever met each other, are now on the side of the road. They found this woman who's clinging to life, and they put her in one of their vehicles, and the other person then speeds into the town, to the nearest town, and they're able to get her to the Wilmington Rescue unit and get her to the hospital in Joliet, where she's The doctors just do a miraculous job saving her life and nursing her back to health, and she's eventually able to recover from her injuries. But she has survived this brutal attack. She was assaulted, sexually assaulted, and her boyfriend. She witnessed her boyfriend being fatally shot right in front of her eyes. The two of them had parked on the side of the road and just were really tired that night and just decided to go to sleep. And then lo and behold, somebody, a stranger, just taps on their window, and no sooner do they wake up from their sleep, but several gunshots blast into the front seat of the vehicle, and Tony Hackett's killed instantly. And the assailant then took his girlfriend, abducted her and kidnapped her and sexually assaulted her over the next several hours inside of his vehicle, which again was a dark colored pickup truck. And she was able to get a really good description of the vehicle as well as the rapist killer.
Mm-hmm. However, this reign of terror is not over. And so there was the ceramic shop in Lamont, Illinois, and there's the owner of the, and some people coming by, patrons of the shop coming by. Can you tell us what happens briefly at this ceramic shop to these four
right.
women?
Right, and in the ceramic shop, there were two ceramic shops. The one in Lamont was the one that the mother and son had just recently purchased. So her son was living right above the one in Lamont. But the mother, Marilyn Bears, she was just in the process of eventually closing down her shop in Joliet, Illinois, and on Route 30. And this one was another crime that defied logic. It was a late Saturday morning, right sometime around noon, and the store owner, as well as three of her customers, all women between the ages of late 20s, late 30s, and then one customer was 75 years old. But all four of them were found dead inside the Greenware by Mary ceramic shop on East Cass Street in Joliet. And they were all fatally stabbed several times, about a dozen times each, with a really long knife that some sheriff's deputies told me, might have been like a machete type of instrument. And then one of the women, the Anna Ryan, the 75-year-old woman, she was also shot. The purses of all these women were stolen as well. I shouldn't say all of them, but three of the purses were stolen, and by the perpetrator. And again, this one deviated from the other crimes because all the other crimes were happening usually late at night or during the overnight hours. But this one happened again late morning, or around lunchtime on a Saturday on August 20th of 1983.
Tell us how this whole thing ends in terms of his arrest, and what was it that. What was it? What were the things that led to this arrest of Milton Johnson?
Well, within a couple weeks of the ceramic shop killings, again with the quadruple murders of these four defenseless women, the Illinois State Police at least went back out to the property of Sam Myers again, where the receipt had fallen at the crime scene out in Homer Township. And they at least wanted to ask more questions about the pickup truck that Sam Myers owned. And
right.
They wound up going out there, and this time they asked the questions of Milton Johnson. And they had done some research, realized who he was, realized he had just gotten out of prison a few months earlier. So they at least were now starting to realize, hey, maybe we have this all wrong. Instead of looking at Sam Myers, maybe it's Milton Johnson who's driving around in his dad's pickup truck this whole time.
Right.
They ask him a few questions. They don't really they at least put him on the spot as far as just asking him, you know, about, like, who he thinks could have done these types of crimes, you know, over the summer of 1983. And, you know, and they ask him about the truck, you know, does he use it, you know, how often? And he at least acknowledges that he does. But what's really interesting about this crime and what happens after this interview is that that truck then goes off the grid. And it's taken off the streets of Joliet, never to be seen from ever again, for that matter, until several months later, you know, when some of the other Will County Sheriff's investigators are able to also piece things together, also realize that Milton Johnson fits the pattern, you know, as far as the violence, a lot of these crimes that he's committing are very similar to the 1970 Pilcher Park rape, and they're able to eventually figure out that this pickup truck is being stashed away, it's being hidden, you know, in about 2 or 3 miles away from where he and his dad lived, and it was being hidden in a garage in somebody else's property. Even though this truck again was one of the main vehicles used by the Johnson, you know, Myers household, this thing had been taken off the streets for now 7 or 8 months. And it was hidden in this garage. So the police impound the vehicle, and eventually what they're able to do is find, among other things, they're actually able to find a receipt that was that linked back to the purchase of a stuffed animal that the two teenagers, the girl that was found left for dead on the side of the road,
right.
And her boyfriend, who was fatally shot and his body was stretched across the front seat of his car, there was, at the time he was found dead, he was found clutching this Tasmanian devil, Looney Tunes from Bugs Bunny cartoons, but he was clutching this this big brown Tasmanian devil toy. He was using it actually as a pillow, you know, when he was sleeping on the front seat of his car. And so he had bought this Tasmanian devil for his girlfriend at the Great America Six Flags amusement park where they had spent their previous day. And and at the time that this crime had happened, not only did the killer, you know, take the girlfriend hostage, but he also reached into the boyfriend's you know, pockets, you know, and took the wallet from him, and you know, as well as her purse and everything. That was another commonality in a lot of these crimes, that purses or wallets were all often taken from the victims as well. But again, back to your question, Dan. Yeah, they found this was a really incredible piece of evidence that really helped seal the deal as far as proving that Milton Johnson was the murderer. But this receipt from the Great America for the Tasmanian devil toy was found 8 months after the crimes happened, you know, inside the seat of the pickup truck that had been stashed away and hidden at Ernest Ulmer's property in Lockport, Illinois.
Mm-hmm. You read about that when they finally arrest him and then charge him, they go ahead with the Tony Hackett murder, and Tanya Little, this is an alias, but she is the one that ID'd him, and she's the one that had to withstand cross-examination. And we haven't even got into the trial antics of Milton Johnson as well, asking to be his own attorney. And this is in a death penalty case. So Tanya was quite convincing in this trial, despite at first the defense tried to say that she didn't identify him or misidentified him because she didn't notice the goatee that Milton Johnson was sporting. So, but they
right.
overcame that at trial.
Yeah, she was very courageous and very believable, and again, at the time that she was taken, you know, at the time she was abducted in the middle of the night, you know, she just witnessed her boyfriend being shot 4 or 5 times right in front of her eyes, you know, and she heard this, you know, deep, you know, I should say low growly voice, you know, telling her to crawl on the ground, you know, don't look up, don't look at me, you know, or I'm going to kill you, you know. And so she was able to make some quick glancing, you know, looks at him while he was driving. But again, it's the middle of the night, you know, she's not able to, and the truck is pitch black, it's dark. And so she's obviously not going to be able to see anything and everything. She's trying to remember what she can. And I'm thinking if the person's driving, they're looking, they're looking forward, you're looking at the side of their face. So if somebody has a goatee, yeah, you might not be able to see that. And just other small things, too, where Milton Johnson was very angry at his sentencing, saying that she didn't, you know, that that she said he was wearing low-top shoes, and he said he always wore high tops. That may be true, but the fact is she was very convincing as far as, you know, and she went to great lengths before she wanted to ever identify a person as being her rapist, because she wanted to make sure that she identified the person, that she was identifying the correct person who did this. And so she looked at, you know, hundreds of mug shots at different points of time, and was eventually able to go in person to the Will County jail, you know, and view a photo lineup. And she was convinced after she saw the lineup and heard the people repeat the phrases, as far as the ones that she was told that night, as she was getting into the pickup truck, you know, she was convinced that, without any doubt, that Milton Johnson was the person who did this to her and her boyfriend, Tony Hackett.
Mm-hmm. Prosecutor Petka sought the death penalty, and we mentioned just in the introduction about that. There was a first trial. What was the and there was a second trial for the August 20th, 1983 ceramic shop slayings. In both trials, what was the verdict in terms of the sentence?
In terms of the sentence, both of the cases ended up with a death penalty for Milton Johnson. So that one death penalty for the murder of Tony Hackett, and then another four death sentences for the ceramic shop murders, which were, you know, the victims being, you know, the women that were killed at the ceramic shop on Joliet's east side.
Mm-hmm. The prosecutor chose not to prosecute for the other five murders, not wanting to imperil the original sentences and convictions, worried about an appeal possibly remotely bringing back all of those convictions and putting those back on appeal as well. Our time is up now, John, but I wanted to urge people to continue with this Tarrytown, USA, to find out more of what happens at this trial, because we would need another hour to be able to go through everything that happens in this remarkable trials, and the first trial and the second trial, and all the decisions that happen as a result afterward, and we don't want to give away the ending. So I want to thank you very much for John, for coming on and talking about Tarrytown, USA, the untold story of Joliet's notorious serial killer. For those that might want to take a look at this, I know this is a Wild Blue press release. Could you tell us about your Amazon page or website? Tell us how they might find out more about this book and others.
Sure, Dan. Again, johnferrick.com, johnferrick.com. I have an author's page there and list all my books there as well. Wildbluepress.com, again, is where you can find this book, Tarrytown, USA, and, you know, in several of my other previous books, including Wrecking Crew, which is the story about Stephen Avery and attorney Kathleen Zellner's efforts to try to overturn his conviction, the case made famous in the Netflix series from Making a Murderer.
Yes.
And again, the easiest place, to be honest with you, just for people to go to look for Tarrytown USA is just go to Amazon.com. Right now it's available in paperback and also ebook, and I'm hoping here in the next several weeks that we'll also have an audiobook version as well for people, since I know those are very popular, and several of my previous books have done real well as far as with the audiobook format as well.
Absolutely. Looking forward to that. Thank you so much, John Ferrick, Tarrytown, USA, the untold story of Joliet's notorious serial killer. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, John Ferrick.
Thanks again, Dan, for having me. You have a great night.
Thank you. Good night.